Off the Bench is a podcast
created by ASCLS
that will discuss the scientific
and not so scientific
ideas in laboratory medicine.
We are joined by members
of ASCLS, fellow scientists,
educators, and researchers,
along with those interested in the profession.
We share ideas
and talk nerdy.
Hello, guys, and welcome back to the Off the Bench podcast. I'm your host, Sophia Chandrasekhar, and I am joined by the wonderful Professor Grace Luberg, who is a professor in Anchorage, correct?
Yeah.
In Alaska, Anchorage. So, Grace, please introduce yourself to the audience.
So, hello, I am Grace Luberg. I am the professor and program director here at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. I came here in 2016, having just finished my master's in clinical laboratory science from Michigan State University. Prior to that, I was a generalist for nearly 35 years. In fact, I always tell my students, I worked 4th of July weekend, and then we got in our truck on Monday, and I drove to Alaska across Canada from central Kansas. One of the reasons that I made this leap was I started going to graduate school when I was in my 50s, learned about the molecular diagnostic program Michigan State had. We were getting molecular into the laboratory. And I always say I wanted to be smarter than the salesman because they'll sell you anything. Mm-hmm. And so I started taking their classes, and which was hard. I hadn't gone to school since 1980. So that's how old I am. And I always tell the students, yes, I'm old enough that when I was running cross country, we didn't have sports bras. And that really makes them think how old I am. More than anything else, they'll be like, wow, because nobody can think of a time before there were sports bras. So anyways, I started doing this, and it was partly because the hospital reimbursed, but partially also I wanted to be interested. And I found that lots of things changed. Like TCA was the Krebs cycle. I'm like, oh, now I know what you're talking about. And it was just amazing to be reintroduced, even though I had done all the continuing education as a medical laboratory scientist. So it just really opened up things. It wasn't necessarily a leap to teach. It's just I really wanted that knowledge base. And so when the opportunity to go to graduate school after I got my molecular diagnostics, and they said, oh, you're a third of the way there. And I'm like, oh, I think I can do this. I kind of got on that merry-go-round and realized the only way I was going to get off was to finish. And my husband, I said, are you sure this is okay? And he goes, oh, we've been paying, you know, we have seven children. He goes, well, we've been paying tuition all this time. What's one more tuition? You know, like, it was okay. So a lot of support from him, and I kept working. And then when I finished, I was doing some adjuncting here and there. And then University of Alaska was looking for a tenure track professor, not realizing that being tenure track meant it was a really complicated application process, being relatively ignorant from that. And so, but the process came. And then when I remember once it was during March when they called, and they were going to fly me up. And I told my husband, I go, I think I'm in the final four. And so it was during March Madness. And so came up here. But I will tell you, when I interviewed here, I wanted to start a research program because the thing I saw with new graduates that would come into our hospital wasn't that they weren't hardworking and smart young women and men, nothing to do with their education, but their ability to look at a problem and go, you know, are we really need to do it this way? Is this something we should be doing? That critical thinking that when I was in school, because when I was in school, it was before DRG. So when I was in school, we were all taught that we were all going to eventually be specialists. Believe it or not, back in the dark ages, we were all going to be specialists. We're going to be experts in our field. We were going to be the number one knowledge source for the hospital. And I wanted to give my students that type of feeling that I had, that when I came out, that I was a scientist, and it was my need to be able to continually do education. And also because I was so surprised when I went back to graduate school, how I really had a gap, even though I felt like I did research all the time. I was always doing outcome-based things here and there when I was on the bench. I was like, why am I doing this? I usually was, what I would do is like, why am I running this test over and over again? And that would start it. I wanted to give that to students. And so I decided that if they were going to hire me, they were going to hire me because I want to start this research program. So that was actually how I came up here then in 2016. And I've been here ever since.
Alaska sounds amazing. What challenges do you have to prepare your students for?
So our students, because Alaska is essentially an island, will not only serve the Anchorage Bowl area, which is more traditional when you think of 300,000, you know, mid-size, like Wichita, Kansas, about the size of Wichita, Kansas, and major hospital complex, but they also travel to serve in other areas like Kotzebue, Nome, and even those are not on the road system. And then things that are on the road system like Soldotna and Homer, and those areas, even though you would think, oh yeah, they could just send stuff to Providence Hospital or send stuff to Alaska Native, it really doesn't work that well because transportation is so difficult in Alaska. We have snow from October until May. We have weather that can change and be difficult to fly out. When we have students that do rotations on the roads, not on the road system, and they have to fly into Kotzebue and work, they relish that, but there's always that concept that, you know, I might not get home to visit my family because if it's fogged in, nobody goes anywhere. I mean, it truly is, in a way, like it was when rural medicine was, you were all by yourself. So rural medicine in Alaska, you truly are all by yourself, because even though they're on a road system, there's only one road. And if that road's impassable and you have to go through the pass, I mean, it's a two-lane road. It's not this huge four-lane highway. When people say, I'm going to go to Homer, and in the lower 48, you'd be like, oh, I could drive to Homer and back in one day. They're like, oh, are you going to spend 3 days? Because the idea of driving to Homer and coming back in one day just isn't done. It's just a whole different system. There's not a 7-Eleven every, you know, 15 miles down the road because of the way our road system is, and how in very many ways outside of Anchorage and maybe outside of Fairbanks, we are very rural, and rural with significant distances and travel that can be hard. Well, we have currently 115 inches of snow this winter, and so it has to go somewhere. And so all of a sudden a two-lane road really is only a lane and a half. And then when that snow melts and you have all that water on it. So back to where anything outside of Anchorage cannot assume they can send samples. Like, there's not going to necessarily be a daily courier going back and forth where you would see in most of the lower 48 areas where everything could be decentralized because you're able to move those samples. Even if you're on the road system, you're all by yourself. So the ability to not only do core lab and hematology, but also micro and chemistry and blood banking, and also when things don't work, when your instrument is down, when your reagents don't come in, when stuff is frozen, when, you know, a sample comes in and you're like, and the, you know, the physician says, you know, I'm not quite sure what to do. You are the expert, and you're the one that's going to help make those decisions. You're truly part of that healthcare team. And Kotzebue, they serve 8,000 square miles, which also includes, you know, small villages, and yet the hospital itself is a 25-bed hospital, but they are the laboratory for that area. And so when there's trauma that happens, you know, we live in the wild, and things, trauma does happen. They have to be there and able to at least stabilize and make sure that patient has got the best laboratory support it needs to then be able to ship out, because there's just no sending stuff down the road. It just doesn't. So I need to have my students not only be very strongly understand the basics of med lab science, like every good program does, but also be able to think independently, to be able to think outside the box if they have to. So when we're training our students here and our program here at UAA, the ability to critical think, the ability to pivot, the ability to bring on new technology and understand it, and recognizing that no one's coming. Well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of people like to come up here so they can visit. So we tend to be the one site that all the vendors want, because although the gal that does stuff for BioMoreau says, well, yeah, they'll do it for 1 year. But then when they find out that they have to get on a plane to go to the Kenai, and the pilot that comes up is wearing a hoodie and a baseball cap, because that's how flying to the Kenai is, and they strap everybody in and they say, okay, everybody just keep your seatbelts on. And when they actually adjust your weight and luggage to make sure the plane is balanced. So yeah, they'll do it once, and then they realize what it's like to truly service the BioMoreau service for the Kenai. I have a good relationship with the gal that comes out and does a lot of things for Vitek for Alaska, and she has Alaska as her territory. But it is a challenging state in that way, because it's, there's, again, there's no road system. When they were putting an instrument in, not her, but I was hearing about another instrument, and they forgot the right cord to plug it in. It's not like, well, they just ship it from down the street. It's like, oh gosh, how are we going to get this cord? When we had to buy a battery pack for our Bitech, and we're like, how much does it weigh? All of a sudden it's like, shipping, how are we going to get it there? I have been known when I go home to the lower 48 to get things that I need and pile up my suitcase and then fly back with it, because shipping up there is just different. But that's also why also our students have to be very skilled in pivoting when they need to. So even in clinical microbiology, I teach all the things we're supposed to know. We talk about MALDI, we talk about molecular, and then I say, okay, so how are you going to do micro when FedEx doesn't make it? So in other words, how are you going to do micro when you don't maybe get your Bitech cartridges, or maybe when something's down? So how can you do micro so at least you can give them a classification? So is it an Escherichia coli? Is it an Enterobacter? Is it a Klebsiella? Is it a Proteus? And with a few spot tests, you might not be able to do a true genus and species, but you can have a major classification so that they can have an antibiotic choice that's better than, I can't say anything because my machine's down or my stuff's not here. So I actually do a management lab in our advanced clinical micro is when FedEx doesn't make it, because that's truly can happen here. When FedEx can't ship, or what you get is frozen on the dock. And so by the time you get it, it's useless. It's very true in a lot of our molecular shipments of things, you know, molecular, very temperature sensitive. So if something happens, how are they going to be able to do it? So a lot of what we do here is not only the traditional training, but also recognizing that you may be working in an area that you're not having the same kind of support that you might have in the lower 48. Yeah, it's exciting.
That's so cool. That's
it. Encourage our graduates to go to work at a distance site, to work off the, we always say off the road system. You know, we always say treat it like a deployment, but because you'll never get that experience again, and you'll really learn how to think as a scientist because you have to, because mm-hmm. There's backup, but it's not the same kind of backup. I mean, you may not even have a pathologist in house. So you're going to have to learn. You are truly, truly the expert. And not only not have a pathologist in house at that time, but that you're the person they're going to call and ask. You're the one doing that gram stain. And you have to make, well, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's staff. You know, you're going to be making those judgment calls because they're going to treat, because they might not be able to ship that person out because weather and everything else. Mm-hmm. So you need to have that confidence as a scientist. And we try to establish that here. That's one of the reasons that I think our research program is good, because it already starts thinking them as scientists, because I want them to think as scientists in the clinical setting, because they may be in that position where they're making decisions like a scientist, because they're it. They are the professional and they are the laboratory expert up there. And they need to know that because of where they potentially could be working.
Mm. That makes complete sense.
So that's what we have to prepare them for. We have to prepare them so that they learn, they continually learn, they're willing to have things change, they're willing to adapt, and they're willing to, it's the Alaskan way. That's what you have to do. Yeah.
I was told to interview you by Dr. Kyle Redding. He said that you are an amazing person to talk to, as well as the fact that there was an article about your research program in ASCP's critical values at University of Alaska in Anchorage. Tell us more about the program and how it all kind of ties together.
So when I came to UAA, like I said, I wanted to develop a research program within the curriculum. I did not want a research project to be something that was only for departmental honors. I mean, we already had that, but I wanted it to be something that every student was involved in. So it needed to be sustainable. It needed to be relevant, and it needed to have something that wasn't dependent on a particular funding cycle. So in other words, it had to be supported by administration and or our clinical partners to maintain. And one of the best ways to do that is a surveillance. As a public health and in clinical microbiology, understanding what microbes are coming in your back door is really essential, because local microbiology really does indicate your local infections. So trying it and thinking about that, and the fact that we live with urban wildlife, so that means that any given time I'm walking around this very large pile of muskeg that everybody kept walking around, I was thinking, you know, if this was Kansas and this was my cattle, I would be cited because you can't do that. You can't do that in the lower 48. If you have cattle and you're moving them from one section to another, you have to make a good effort to keep it clean. You just can't leave that. But nobody seemed to care here. They actually thought it was, you know, it was natural. It was organic. There's nothing wrong with it. And nobody had looked at it. So that's where we started. We started looking at it and developing protocols where there was no protocols. And I developed this MLS team where anyone that's in our program can meet every week so that we can have everyone's ideas, because I was no expert in moose scat cultures, but I was an expert in cultures. And we did a lot of reading. We did some reading about, they did moose cultures and caribou cultures in Denmark. We were reading a lot of international journals, a lot of journals that came from, we were reading about agriculture journals and how does, you know, how does fecal matter and animals affect workers? I mean, so it wasn't just your laboratory, you know, medical journals. We were reading all sorts of journals, often articles, because we're trying to get a handle on this. And what we found is we found significant antimicrobial resistance that was an environmental impact. And we built that, and we built our model, and it's built in both the 200 level micro class and the 300 level micro class, where they actually do the data analysis, the data, you know, they make the data. We don't do mock-ups. So when we're doing streptococcal identifications in 203, yes, they learn all the basics like we always do, but they don't have unknowns. We have research cultures. They are truly unknowns. And because we get a lot of alpha hemolytic strep, we get Enterococcus faecalis and faecium. Because we collect goose samples, we look for antimicrobial resistance. We look for linzolid resistance. We look for vancomycin resistance. They learn to do both E-tests and DIS-tests as a screening. And then we run it on a VITEC. We have a VITEC compact too, so we can get our breakpoints. They easily can tell you not only Enterococcus faecalis and faecium, but same thing, say Enterococcus galarium, Enterococcus calceflavus. These things come off their tongue because we're isolating it. You don't isolate and culture those things in mock-up cultures. You isolate and culture those things because that's in that fecal matter. And so that's what those students do. My advanced students are the ones that we look for the antimicrobial resistance in our gram negatives. Mm-hmm. We do a survey on all the E. coli we isolate, but they're the ones that actually start looking for ESBL and carbapenem resistance. That's what we're doing this week. They learn how to look at mixed cultures. They learn how to identify all the gram negatives. And then they do antimicrobial susceptibility testing. We screen them using a DIS diffusion. And then we run everything on the VITEC Compact 2 for our breakpoints. We do an ESBL screen and a carbapenem screen. And then we have a new confirmation method that we're using for carbapenem enzymes. This is what we do in our classes. And then all that data then gets analyzed every week by our weekly group meeting that we have. It's a hybrid meeting. So students can be on campus or they can log in. And it's every week all year round. And we talk about what our data is. Students can drop in and drop out as they need to. They just want to listen and interest. But after a while, we'll have a core few people that want to be a little bit more involved. And then they become partners in a research. Every given year, we have four prongs of research we do. One is antimicrobial resistance with our alpha hemolytic streptococci. Another one is our gram negative bacilli, both a surveillance of E. coli over a period of time, just that organism. And then now also a surveillance of our carbapenem resistance that we're seeing along with ESBL, both in Enterobacter and Klebsiella. But we're also looking at Hafnia. Got to realize these students isolate organisms that are in our environment that become opportunistic infections in the hospitals, but they're actually very comfortable with them. The fact that they know what Hafnia looks like is pretty amazing. They know what Acinetobacter looks like because we actually isolate this and we do sensitivity. So those are already in their background, even though that's not your typical organism that you isolate. But ironically, those are the organisms that we isolate in some of our severe ICU patients as an opportunistic infections, and our students are already aware of them. We also look at parasitology. So surveilling not only Giardia, but also Cryptosporidium. We're recognizing that there's a significant amount of Cryptosporidium that's colonized. And the EIA method that we have is only looking at Cryptosporidium parvum. But to assume that's the only Cryptosporidium that can be pathogenic when you lived in a shared environment is why we actually do modified acid fast. And my students actually look at that, review it, and they do that. And then finally, we're now looking at soil and water. We've always looked at enteric pathogens because we have subsistent diet here. So people eat moose, people eat bear. So we're always maintaining that. And we have not had any kind of E. coli 0157 isolated from moose until just this last year. We've isolated E. coli 0157 from bear droppings, but that didn't surprise us because bears eat garbage. So that's where they're picking it up. But when moose started picking it up, moose don't eat garbage. Moose eat water, plants, and trees. So when we had our first ESBL producing organism from, and it was an ESBL and it was a chicotoxin producing E. coli. So it was like the scariest E. coli I could imagine to isolate. And so when that was isolated, we knew that we had to start doing, again, this is the team talks about this, like, well, we need to start doing water and soil samples. So we've moved to a pilot study on water and soil samples, and we were isolating 0157 from soil samples, which means if it's in the soil, then it's in the plants. It's in the plants, and it increases opportunity for animals, and of course, animals and human exposure. And I know one of the things you want to talk about is this whole research program is under the One Health model. The One Health model means that antimicrobial resistance, under what we're looking for, is not just antibiotics in a healthcare setting. It's antibiotic usage in our environment and urban animals and how we react with those animals in that close shared environment. And it's all about colonization. Everyone has a significant amount of housing insecure population. Any major city has that, and we're not immune to that. And they're camping and living in unsecured housing alongside where all this wildlife is, all the scat is, all the soil is, and all the water. And we would be somewhat ignorant to not to assume that there is not some crossover. So what we look at is we look at not only what we're isolating, but prevalence, not so much that we know how many moose are sick. So we're not really looking at the moose themselves or this bear themselves. I always say it could be just one typhoid Mary moose that's defecating the entire town of Anchorage. All I want to know is how many piles and how much concentration in areas where there's also high concentration of human interaction with urban wildlife. And so we look at areas along creek beds. We also look at an urban. So we have our sites are sort of defined that way. Is it a medical, like a UMed district area where the medical facility is? Is it along a creek bed? Is it in a urban setting where there isn't any water source? Because the idea of water source would increase possibility of transmission. So that's what we're looking at, and we're looking at prevalence. And so we've been doing this since 2018, but I have to say our data is best from 2019 on, because from 2018 and 2019, I tell my students, like, we're thrown against the wall, see if it sticks. I protocols, you know, nobody's doing this, right? So what our idea is that if you have a moose scat or bear scat and it's frozen and then it thaws, what is your public risk assessment? And so we model it that way. We don't do molecular sequencing, because what we want to know is what is actually viable. And what's really scary is that sometimes when we have a moose scat and it's dried, it's frozen, we thaw it and put it in a warm environment, and it grows 4+ ESBL producing E. coli. And that's the only thing it is growing. So it's not so much that we see antimicrobial resistance, but often it's the only thing that's growing. And we don't identify anything unless it's at least 2 to 3+. So this is not just like a single colony. So all I can think of is that moose scat thaws in that warm, moist environment, and it starts growing, because we all know E. coli can sort of start growing at that room temperature, and all of a sudden their dog comes and eats it or whatever. It grows and colonizes in that dog, and the dog is something that comes up to you, and that's the One Health model, and then you become colonized with it. And there is plenty of documented research, especially in the veterinarian science, that can happen, that animal transfer from your domesticated animals can transfer to humans. And, you know, like any place else, where's your dog's going to run? So that's what we look at. And that's our risk assessment. And that's what we do.
That's so, I'm just floored, because, and I don't have much to say, because I just think it's so fascinating. And I just love listening to you talk about the program and like, and the research, because it's just so cool. Like,
well, and it's good research. I mean, we go to conferences. We're speaking. I just got notification, our carbapenem surveillance, because it's a surveillance. We have been looking at this. So when you look at it over a period of time, you can make assumptions based over data over a period of time. I tell my students, we are asked to speak, and we are in. So we're speaking at ASM. Our abstract got selected for speaking, which I don't know about you, but that's a big deal. They don't just, you know, they just were going to be under the environmental antimicrobial topic or whatever, and they have eight speakers, and we're one of eight of those abstracts that are speaking.
Congratulations.
It's because what we're doing is good science. What we're doing is we're not making any assumptions unless our data points us that way. And that comes out of those weekly meetings where we're looking at spreadsheets. We're saying, can we actually say this? Or are our variables consistent? Is our protocol, you know, consistent enough for us to make these decisions? Well, when you have students doing that, their power of their critical thinking is just phenomenal, because we don't just say, oh, this is a great project. We have this idea. We got this results and here it is. It's like, does this result mean anything? Can we actually say this? What else do we need to do? Has anybody else said anything about this? Mm. You know, and we got really excited because on my research gate, one of our first things we did back in 2019 got its first citation where somebody cited our work. And I told that to our students because it's ongoing. They know that some of the data has been from previous students. You know, mm-hmm. all of this has been built in from the program. And so they're doing research cultures this week, and they're like, they know it's not just getting it right to get an A or to get a grid. I mean, they need to get it right because it's part of our research, and they know our research is important. And all of a sudden, all of that labeling and all of the isolating and all of that, it's, and how are you ever going to build that unless it's, and everybody does it. So the other thing that I like about our program is that we talk about diversity and equity in research. And anytime that there is an application process to get into a research project, to work with a professor, you are going to lose equity because there is going to be a population of students that will just not apply. Hmm. But when everyone, including our MLT students, because our 200 level micro is MLT students, every single person has to do it. And every single person has an opportunity to be on these weekly meetings. I have two MLT graduates whose names are put on abstracts that went to the ASCP conference, and they have a DOI link to their abstract in an Oxford prep. And one of these students is now going to grad school after he's graduated, Hispanic, first generation, and he came in and he was a BC student as an MLT, eventually got his MLS, eventually go to grad school. And when I asked him, he says, "Professor, you said I could do research. You didn't say that because I was special, I could do research. You said everyone could do research. And in fact, you told me that you were happy I was in the group because a BC student knows when things don't go right. And sometimes in research, things don't go right. And that you have to look at it and go, why didn't it go right? And I wanted those people on your team. You actually told me that you wanted me, a BC student, on your team." How powerful that is. But he would have never done that had he had no choice. Everyone's doing it. Everyone's doing it. And yeah, he's in grad school right now. He's down in Reno. I think that's where he's working now. Mm. But he's signed to grad school. I think University of Cincinnati. I did a letter of recommendation for him. I mean, how cool is that? And that's what we're supposed to be doing too. If we are truly educators, that's what we're supposed to be doing. Empowering everyone that comes into our program, that they have, every single person in our program has the intelligence to do research. You don't have to just do departmental honors. I mean, again, we have that, and that's important, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I believe that when they have no choice, it's when you have equity, right?
And
it's just part of the program.
So my background, I actually did biology. I have a BS in biology, so I did biology first. And I remember wanting to try to do some research, but I was told, because I was a BC student in the bio program, I was not allowed to, never touched it, couldn't be involved. So this, hearing this level of equity and making students do it, because, and it's empowering students to be able to do it at no matter what level they are, I think is fantastic. If there are students out there who are interested in doing research, but are coming up with these barriers, like how I encountered a barrier of your grades aren't what I want it to be, so I don't want you to be a part of this research, what's something you can advise students maybe try to do?
So it's difficult in a university system. And I'm not saying because the university system in itself has barriers, but sometimes the way the grant funding cycles are, sometimes the way a organization exists in a program, sometimes those barriers are not meant to be barriers, but just are kind of institutional. It's just the way things are structured, and which is unfortunate, which is why I truly believe that when you embed it and it's part of your student learning outcome, when it becomes part of your student learning outcome, then it also becomes part of the funding of your program. So it becomes part of the learning. Plus, we get tremendous support from our clinical partners. But if I was a student and I was stuck, you might not be able to do anything within the university system that you're at. But that does not mean that you can't do what I did, because there wasn't big research when I went in. But I joined organizations. So I joined ASM as a student. And then I continued. And within that, you start learning of opportunities. You learn about reading journals and reading research. And what I tell my students is that you want to have an interest. Before you decide that you want to go to grad school, you should at least have an interest in what type of research you want to do. And the best way to have an idea of what kind of research you want to do is to basically read research. And when you join organizations and you go to conferences or you go to webinars, you start learning what's out there in research and you start wondering, well, that sounds really interesting. And then you start focusing on that. And then you start aligning yourself to how can I be active in that instead of just trying to find somebody and just doing a lot of their lab work. I'm not saying that that doesn't have benefit. It does. But what has even more benefit is when you have a personal interest in it. So when I came to UAA, it wasn't because I all of a sudden decided to pick up a project that was already existing. I'd been interested in antimicrobial resistance since I had been a member of ASM since I was 1980. and I'd been going to conferences and I'd been learning about antimicrobial resistance and I've been learning about Molotov and I've been learning about outcome-based medicine and I've been thinking about it all this time. And again, when I was on the bench, I was doing research all the time because, and not that you were doing like, you know, what people think of research, they go, oh, I'm going to run all these samples, I'm going to get this data, and I'm going to learn that, you know, this gene sequence causes cancer. Yes, that is research. But a lot of research is like, is it really important to be doing this test? What is this test actually doing? Research is saying, why am I doing this? Is there a better way? Or is this giving me the number I want? Or is this adequate? It's that mindset is what research really is. Everything else is just data. You're looking at data and you're trying to figure out, is this something that we need to do? And if we do anything in the medical laboratory field is we generate data. So I would tell that student is that if you're unlucky and not getting anywhere, when you first start going into the field, join a professional organization that interests you, like whether it's clinical chemistry, hematology, micro, blood banks, start going to those conferences, making those connections, getting involved. I mean, that is truly one of the best ways that you can do, especially in a specialty area. And ASCLS and ASCP also does, but I always belong to those, but especially want to develop a specific interest, look into those areas. My students are always surprised when I tell them when I took my ASCP exam, and oh, by the way, I got a 402, and I still remember that. 400 is passing, doesn't matter, pass is pass, right? Is that my micro scores were horrible. And yet when I graduated, I went to my first place I worked, and they went, great, new grad, the inspector's coming, review the procedure manual. Because back then, we were supposedly new, all the new stuff. And I tell them that's the empowerment I want you to have when you leave here, is that you can start critically, not your first day on the job. You don't ever want to give it to somebody, but after you get past orientation and you've been working the bench for a few months, think about what you're doing and why you're doing something. And that's where it starts. It's the curiosity. Mm. But true, if somebody is a student and they're just frustrated and they really, especially as a student, those student memberships can be really inexpensive. So I would, and I encourage our students here, I would join an organization and start, if you're able to, go to conference, go to regional conference. Again, I'm a micro person. Wasn't when I was in school. I was a clinical chemist. I was going to do chemistry. I mean, back in the day, we had to take so much chemistry. We all graduated with chemistry majors with our Bachelor of Science and Med Lab Science. I mean, because we had to take so much chemistry back in the day. So I was going to be a clinical chemist. So just because you think you're going to be something doesn't always work out that way. But I joined ASM, and I'm telling you, it really made things, my whole career, created, started, because I joined ASM back in 1981.
From all the research that's been done by the students and you, what do you think is the most interesting or terrifying thing? Like, I'm personally terrified by that one stool sample you said that has a, you know, it's got E. coli of all sorts and just, ugh.
So, yeah. So what really surprised us, which is why also I think we're getting some notification or getting some notice, especially under the One Health model. So we actually spoke at the International One Health Model conference in Fairbanks. Of course, granted, we're circumpolar, so it's something to be nice about living in Alaska. So it was really close, so we could go. But it was international. I mean, people from Germany, people from Denmark, I mean, and we spoke, is that we focus on urban because I want to be consistent with our modeling. But anytime students travel, people hike, you know, it says something when your assistant dean of the College of Health is carrying, you know, scat collection kits when he's hiking up in Denali, so he brings us samples. Okay, that says something about your program when your dean will do that for you. Because I have citizen scientists, so I have a procedure that is able for them to do that and how to maintain it and to make it so anyone can pick it up. So when we have things where there is no antibiotic pressure anywhere and we're finding antimicrobial resistance, it amazes me. We're pretty certain it has to do with the, you know, the fly zone of our migrating birds. But the idea that I can have an Enterococcus faecalis that is vancomycin resistant, Linzold resistant, coming from a caribou sample up near Tok, Alaska. And I encourage everyone to see where Tok, Alaska is. That's not anywhere near any kind of antibiotic pressure. That surprised me, you know, why? And it's linzolid resistant. Why would we see that? And it's not just anecdotal. It's, you know, we see enough of it. It's like, why is it there? And it's also viable. That's the other thing that surprised me. And of course, a lot of literature review, you know, I can see why they do a molecular shotgun approach. It's clean, it's nice, prints a lot of data. But it doesn't really tell you viability. I always tell students, you know, DNA amplified, dead or alive, doesn't really matter. But when we actually grow it, and when we grow it on a sample and it's the only thing growing, so in other words, we don't have a mixed flora. We're just growing 3+ Enterococcus faecalis, vancomycin, linzolid resistant from a caribou sample. That's the only thing growing except for maybe a half neogram negative. In other words, we have very limited normal flora, but what survives is often multi-drug resistant. That surprised me. And that's in your environment. And if it's in the fecal matter, it's in the soil. If it's in the soil, it's in the water. If it's in the water and the soil, then it's in the environment. And our exposure is there. And so I try to tell my students, and I do to anyone that listens, that we have to stop thinking of antimicrobial resistance as something that happens in ICU. We have got to stop thinking that. We have to recognize that you can have an individual, especially someone that has limited housing or unsecured housing and is showing up in your ER, could be colonized with a multi-drug resistant Enterococcus or a multi-drug resistant E. coli because they picked it up from a shared environment, from an outside shared environment. And they can come into your hospital and be colonized with it. And like I tell my students, a lot of the infections we have, we do to ourselves. There's not as many infections we get from an outside exposure. A lot of it is because the E. coli in our body decides to give us infection. That's where it comes from. So if we are colonized with it, then we're going to bring it in and we're going to risk exposure to other individuals with that. So that was really surprising. I really did not expect. And when I started seeing carbapenem, the students sort of get kind of excited because I validate everything on our Vitek analyzer, and it's, you know, it's in the flow, what we call the flow room, which there's no flow in it. I don't know how I got the flow room, but it's, you know, like, you know, names get names. And I rarely swear because, you know, you can't. But let's face it, I'm a laboratory professional. And I'm like, you know, WTF, because I have no idea where this came from. You know, why do I have a carbapenem resistant organism coming from some moose that's up near, you know, where nobody is? Somebody picked it up, because my students are so good that even when they see, sometimes you have, okay, we have roadkill, people hit moose. And unlike the lower 48, if we hit a moose, it gets field dressed and we use a meat. I mean, that's what they do. And so they came along an accident where they were field dressing a moose, and my students are, they'll get those samples. So they know that everybody's got collection kits. So here's this moose alongside the road between, you know, Fairbanks and Anchorage, where there's nothing else around, and they get samples for us and they test them, and I have a carbapenem resistant E. coli. Why? Yeah. On a moose sample. And you got to remember, E. coli is not normal flora. We don't grow E. coli in every single moose sample. See, that's just it. We don't grow E. coli because, again, your bowel depends on what you eat, and mm-hmm. they eat treats.
Sort of like a prediction to the future. Can you see like public health changes coming from this data, do you think?
Oh, I really believe so. So one of the questions at the One Health conference, they said, well, should we not let our dogs go outside? And, you know, people have changed how their dogs, their domesticated pets are. I mean, when our kids were growing up, you know, they were farm dogs. I mean, no dog came inside the house, right? And now I have a lab that, you know, not only is on our couch. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, the kids are just amazed. Mom would never have a dog in house when we're growing up, but now she has this dog. And so doesn't mean we can't do that, but I think we need to be aware of what's coming in from the outside.
Mm.
And we have to be just much more aware that it's just that, yes, as long as we are healthy and our immune system is good, we're probably fine. But I think we need to really think about our exposure of our domesticated pets to people that are more immunocompromised. You know, I remember at one time that they thought camps for cystic fibrosis was a really good thing. And then they found out it was spreading Buchholder. I mean, nobody realized that that environmental and that exposure between caused this horrible gram negative that was poor outcome for these individuals. I mean, everybody thought camp's great for kids, right? But it turned out that shared environment wasn't a good idea. Well, we may have to want to think a little bit more of our shared environment with our domesticated animals if we have a significant amount of what I call urban wildlife. But then again, as our wildlife encroach on our environment, so you think of deer, you think of, I don't know about you, but geese manage to scat everywhere. You know, it's everywhere. How do we handle that? How do we handle composting? I am finally convincing people here not to make jewelry out of moose scat. You know, it's that awareness that just because it's natural does not necessarily mean it doesn't have antimicrobial resistance. So that is the thing, more of an awareness, not necessarily that we have to stop what we're doing, but maybe be more aware of our interactions. Maybe you don't want to have, you know, pets being in, you know, in hospitals as support animals. I don't know. You know, you have to be a little careful about what you're doing, because assuming that they're not carrying anything that's antimicrobial resistance and they are in a outdoor environment, I don't know that you can be 100% certain at this time from what we're finding.
Okay.
It'd be really nice to have other MedLab science programs culturing geese scat and sharing it with me. I really ever always say, you know, it's there seems to be lots of quantity of it out there, you know, and that's the one thing that's
there's
consistent.
Plenty here in North Carolina. There's
that's right. And that's the one thing that's
why by my house.
That's, and we do geese because it's we're a flyby state. And so, you know, that's one of the things we're thinking where it comes from, but not everything. Not all the enterococcus resistance, yes, I could say that's probably where it's coming from. But that's also, you know, the one thing I tell our students, we're very specific of what we can say and what we can't say. So people ask us, well, what's causing this? And we're like, well, we have a thought, we have ideas, but that's not what we're researching. What we're researching is surveillance, prevalence, and patterns. And so I think if, you know, other programs are listening and thinking about this, the strength in our research is that it is a surveillance. So if you're thinking about doing something that could be ongoing, surveillance type projects are excellent because over a period of time, they can give you really strong indications, but also be careful about what you're doing so that you can be strong in what you're saying. So again, we are guessing, but we're not making, and because literature reviews and what's been out there, but we don't actually truly make that assumption. We don't say, this is where our antimicrobial resistance is coming from. We just know that it's there. It's kind of like, we're not sure, but, you know, danger, danger, you know, be careful. Yeah.
If there are programs or even students who want to reach out to you or like find out more information on maybe how they can start their own program or advice on how to even look into starting a program like this, are they able to contact you, or do you have any resources for them?
If you just find University of Alaska Anchorage, you know, you can always find my email here at the university, which is, it's long. It's GLEUBURKE@alaska.edu. You can always reach out. I'm always open to help people with protocols, what you want to do, how you maybe can get your clinical partners to help out with you. So we get a lot of in-kind donations, because in the beginning there wasn't as much, and now we get almost everything we need because they see the importance of it. And not only because the students come out with just phenomenal microbiology background, they just do. I mean, their concept, their understanding of ESBL and carbapenemase resistance, their understanding of AES, their understanding that antimicrobial resistance patterns have to follow an identification of a gram negative is far beyond what most MLS graduates have. I mean, their understanding of how this works and epidemiology is just because we do it. So they see that, and they see benefit in that. So that can also help gain that. I can also, but also give them insights. They can also come up and, you know, come to our program. We have a really good MLS. So any high school students, Alaska's beautiful. This has got to be the funnest place for students to live. There's housing on campus. We have on-campus housing. It looks like it's more of an urban campus, because a good percentage of our students do live, you know, off campus, but we do have housing, mostly for our out-of-state students. We have an excellent program here. It's really great, great skiing, great snowboarding, great. It's just fun. I mean, if you are a young person, what do you got to lose, right? To come up here and go to school, reach out to me, high school seniors, you're thinking about coming up here, reach out to me, because we have our freshmen declare majors if we can. And if they do their application and you do your gen eds, it's your kind of, we do rolling admission. And so you have your ducks in a row, and you can get done. If you start right away as an MLS major in our program, you're done in 4 years. I say 4 years in a summer, because our rotations are spring and summer. So you do 4 years in a summer. And some of our students will, you know, do a rotation in Sitka, Alaska in the summer. There's nothing more beautiful than Sitka, Alaska in the summer, and you're doing clinical rotations. So come up to Alaska. It's a great place to be. And I'm here. So
it sounds amazing.
It is. It is.
Do you think you'd ever, since you said you have your weekly meetings, a hybrid weekly meeting to go over the data, do you think you'd ever make it have maybe an open meeting for people who might be interested just on listening in?
We could think of it. You know, the one thing that the reason I had closed it before is mainly because I wanted to make sure, again, how universities are organized,
right.
The MLS students. So, because occasionally we have interest from the biology department and that, and I'll say, well, it's great, major in MLS and you can be part of this. Because there's something to be said when you have 10 undergraduates with abstracts published in an Oxford press. I mean, it does tend to get a little bit of attention from people that want to be a part of that, not recognizing that all the data that's getting collected is all collected by the MLS students. That's why it's sort of a weekly thing. But we would be, I'll talk to our, again, it's a team. I'm the facilitator, but I'll talk to our students and see what they say. We do have a research symposium that we do every January, and we open it up and the students do it. And it's a summary of the research we're doing and what we're moving forward. And that is always open up. And I can, if you email me, I can give you the Zoom link for that and you can listen to it.
That'd be
It'll
fantastic.
Give them an opportunity. Yeah. And it actually showcases. And our students, I do a presentation, but our students do all the presentations and answer questions. And it's really cool. It's usually about a 2-hour symposium, but it's something that we do every January since January 2019, we've been doing a symposium. So this was kind of cool. It was our fifth anniversary, our fifth anniversary symposium, research symposium.
But we congratulations on reaching the fifth anniversary too.
It is really neat. I cannot say how much the research, and it's not just for our students, but all the things that universities want students to have: critical thinking, communication. And then because what we do affects individuals that are sometimes our most vulnerable, So the idea of diversity, the idea of community, importance to that, what we want students to know when they leave the university is not just something that they learn because they take a cultural diversity course, but they actually live it. I always ask my students, you know, I teach an intro to research class and we talk about diversity in that. And one of my questions is that how do you define, you know, equity in healthcare? And very often, but I had a student just this last year wrote, he says, well, if we're not taking care of the most vulnerable in our populations and recognizing the risk they have for antimicrobial colonization, then why are we in healthcare? And and that doesn't come because they read a PowerPoint slide. That doesn't come because they read the text. That comes because the work they do here has meaning to the research that we do, that has meaning to our environment and our population, and it's relevant. And they are very, you know, and they're very proud of that. And so the students, even though the students this week are doing research cultures, and we just found out about the ASM conference, and even though their data is not included because it's new data, the sense of pride is just phenomenal. And they're scientists when they leave this program. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And to wrap up the episode for today, because I hate to wrap this up because I adore talking to you. I love listening to you talk, and like your excitement makes me feel so excited. I just want to know more and almost wish I would go back to school, but I'm also like not ready to go back to school. one kind of closing question we'd like to ask some people just to round things out. Either what's your favorite bacteria or what's your favorite test in microbiology?
So, you know, my favorite bacteria was always Haemophilus, because it really smelled great back when we used to smell plates, you know, before you just knew when you opened up that incubator. And we don't see Haemophilus as much anymore. I tell my students, you know, with the vaccinations that are coming out, colonization's just not there. And if you don't have a reservoir, then, you know, then you don't necessarily see it as much, but that smell. And so when I'm, you know, making my stock plates and growing Haemophilus, I'm like, oh, that brings me back. And it brings me back to the days when I was working micro as a young person. But the story I always like to tell young people, because they always assume that we weren't young once, you know, the students. And I've had years on the bench, working second shift and being a generalist for years. And there was one day, you know, like all young people, that I didn't get a whole lot of sleep the night before. And I'm working under the biological hood, and it has that hum, right? And next thing I know, my head has hit the thing and I am sleeping, and I finally kind of wake myself up, because of course, you know, you're by yourself, it is a Saturday morning, you know, and you know, and I'm by myself, and I finally come out and I go, wasn't anybody concerned they hadn't heard from me for the last hour? And they go, well, Grace, you're always quiet. And so I laugh, but I still remember that. To this day, I think I was 21 years old. I remember clunk, you know how that is. You know, the hood's right there, right? In your head. And I had fallen asleep on the hum of the hood. So that's always tell my students that it's always, you know, they see me as this person that does this research and reads and excited. And I remind them that I was an average student. I have dyslexia. I worked through high school and worked through college. I got a 402 on my ASCP exam, which I still remember.
It's still passed.
Well, the whole thing is that doesn't define who you are. What defines who you are is curious, wanting to know why, willing to continue to learn, willing to continue to expand your knowledge base, and always making sure that patient care is your center, the reason why you're doing something. And as long as you do that and you don't lose that, you will become a scientist. And research will just be a part of that, because the only way we can consistently be looking for good patient care is you're going to be going, why am I doing this test? Because that's what you're doing. And that's what I tell my students. It's not because you're a straight A student. It's not because you got to be at the right place at the right time. It's because you really want to do the best for your patient. And when you do that, then you're going to always be questioning what you're doing.
Fantastic way to finish off the show. Fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much for just coming on and talking. And, you know, we'd love to have you back if you want to feel free to talk about anything else.
Anytime you have, you know, I have all sorts of ideas. I just love sharing not only my experience in the lab, but actually encouraging young people. I cannot say without a doubt what a phenomenal career medical laboratory science was for me. Having the opportunity to pivot many times during having children, when your life changes, and still allowing me to be a professional is not something that happens in every field. Mm-hmm. And then the flexibility of even pivoting and to teach and knowing that I probably have trained a good portion of the laboratory scientists in Alaska gives me a strong sense of pride. And of course, life is always life, but it does help when you align yourself with a partner who's flexible too, who will say, yes, we'll drive across, you know, Canada, which by the way, I have no sense of direction. And so he was in charge of moving, or his charge was moving. And I remember finally doing the Google thing, Salina, Kansas to Anchorage, Alaska. And I walk out to the living room and I'm like, we have to drive through Canada to get to Alaska. And he went, well, how'd you think we're going to get there? And I go, I don't know, go to Seattle, take a right. I had no idea. So students think that's funny because they have this concept that you know everything. I'm like, No, I had a hard time knowing even where Michigan was until we had to drive to Michigan so I could go to class. And also a shout out to Michigan State University, because I need to, because they changed my life. I was this old person coming to their on-campus, you know, molecular diagnostics course. I think I was older than almost everybody except maybe Dr. Gerlich, you know. So anyways, they changed my life. They have been so supportive. So a shout out to especially Dr. Gerlich and Dr. Rachel Morris, who have been this the key to provide this wonderful life where I go to work and if a moose is in your driveway, that's actually an excuse to be late for work.
All right, and thank you for listening, listeners. We'll see you on the next episode. Bye.